now we're finally going to get to see a quantum algorithm. So we're going to see an example of a problem where we can get some advantage from quantum computing. Although you'll see that, you know, with this simple example that we start with, the advantage will be maybe not as much as we might hope for, although it's possible to do better things. So I think we're going to probably spend most of the time talking about this Deutsch-Joser problem. There's another problem called Simon's problem that that gives a more dramatic separation. And if we have time, we may talk a little bit about that, but we probably won't be able to get into the details. So then next week, we'll really get into quantum algorithms for more interesting problems, starting with the factoring problem. Although to do that, we'll have to build up some background on something called the quantum Fourier transform. Okay, so let's get started. I just want to describe a problem that it turns out you can solve better with a quantum computer. And you know, this problem is interesting mainly because of this separation, not because it's a problem we particularly want to solve, but because it's a problem we can prove something about. And again, this problem is going to be in the black box model that I introduced at the end of the last lecture, where we don't have an explicit input, but rather we have a black box that encodes the input. Okay, so here's the problem. We're going to be given a black box input, which is a string of length. I want to think of it as a string of length 2 to the n. And you know, the reason for that is, well, I mean, one way of thinking of this string is that it's the truth table for a function on n from n bits to a bit. So you know, the values of the string will just be bits. And to specify the index of one of the positions in this string will take n bits to specify, right? Because there's 2 to the n places in the string, so you can specify one of those 2 to the n places using an n-bit string. So another interpretation of this is that the thing that's inside the black box is the truth table of a function that has an n-bit input, because that's the thing that you're going to put into the black box. Okay? So in some sense, we want to think of the input size as being n, but the string inside the box will have length 2 to the n. And now, what the problem is to decide whether the function, whether the black box string x is either a constant string, meaning every character in the string is the same, or a balanced string, meaning that there's an equal number of zeros and ones in the string. Okay, so decide whether x is constant. Which means that there's only two possibilities, that it's the all zero string or the all one string or balanced. And balanced means that there's an equal number of zeros and ones. And of course, that's that's always possible for any n, because n is a power of 2, so in particular it's even, so you could have an equal number of zeros and ones. And this is an example of what's sometimes called a promise problem. We're promised that the input is one of these two things. It's either constant or balanced. We want to determine which it is. And so, for example, we know that the string inside the black box is not a string that has, all zeros but a one in one place. It's either a string that's all zeros, all ones, or it has half zeros and half ones. And we want to decide which is the case. So, this is kind of reminiscent of that language, balance that I mentioned before, but this is not an explicit computational problem in the usual sense. It's a black box problem. And what we want to do is we want to understand how many queries do we have to make to the bits of x to figure out which case we're in. Okay, so I'd like to first just think about, for now, let's just think about deterministic algorithms. Let's not think about randomized algorithms where we might only succeed with some probability. We'll see that the quantum algorithm that we come up for this problem actually will work perfectly. So let's just think about deterministic algorithms, which simplifies things a little bit more when we think about classical algorithms. And now something we might like to understand is, what's the classical query complexity of this problem? Right? So how many queries do I have to make to the bits of x before I can figure out, before I can be sure that the string is either constant or balanced, in the worst case, over all inputs? Can you see? So like, for example, if I made 2 to the n queries, that would definitely be sufficient, because then I would know the whole string, and then I would know whether it's constant or balanced. But, you know, maybe I can get by with fewer. Just over half, right, exactly. Because, yeah, so if I query it on, you know, half of the input bits, it could be that I see all zeros or that I see all ones. And if I do that and I've only queried on half of the, you know, on two to the n all over two places, then, you know, it could be that I just got unlucky and it's a balanced string, but I happened to query in exactly the places where, you know, it was always zero. So I don't know what the answer is if I only make half the maximum possible number of queries. But if I make one more, then it actually doesn't matter which bits I query. Then I can be sure that the function is constant or balanced on the basis of what I see. Because, you know, as soon as I see two different values, then I know that the thing is not constant. And if I query on enough inputs, then I have to see that in the case where the function is balanced. Okay. So so what we just argued is the following. So the deterministic classical query complexity is 2 to the n over 2 plus 1. And that's not an asymptotic statement. That just is what the query complexity is. Okay, good. All right, so now what we would like to do is come up with a quantum algorithm that does better than this. And it turns out that there's a quantum algorithm that does a lot better than this. So there's a quantum algorithm that will figure out which case we're in with certainty using only one query. Right? So classically, we need exponentially many queries. And quantumly, we need a number of queries that's just independent of n. But one query is enough. So that's what we're going to see. Okay, so to come up with a quantum algorithm, first of all, we need to recall what the black box means in the context of quantum queries in some quantum circuit. So here's what the quantum black box does. It acts as follows. So we have two registers. So one of them stores an index that we want to query. So that's a number between 1 and 2 to the n, or you could think about that as being represented as a string of bits that represents some integer, I don't know, say between 0 and 2 to the n minus 1. So, this is some index into the string, and then this is a place where we want to write the answer. And this is going to get mapped to, the input is going to stay around, and then the second thing gets XORed with the value of the ith bit. Right? Okay. So that's the way the black box behaves. Now there's kind of a trick that we're going to use, which is going to simplify the analysis of the algorithm, which is something called phase kickback. And that trick behaves as follows. So what the idea is that we're going to so to have interesting things happen in a quantum algorithm, we're going to have to make queries in superposition. Certainly, we're going to have to query a superposition of different inputs. But another thing that turns out to be useful is to think about what happens when you query with this bit in superposition. And in particular, we're going to see what happens when we query on the minus state, the superposition with a relative minus sign between 0 and 1. Okay. So let's see what happens if we query on bit I with the second register in a minus state, right? So by the minus state, I mean 0 minus 1 over root 2. Okay, so let's see what happens if we make a query with that particular input state. And, you know, we're going to keep track of some global phase, and we might, in general, later take a superposition of different values of I for this register. Okay, so let's see what happens. So now there are two terms in the superposition, and we'll just write them down separately. So if we've got a 0 here, then we're going to get the value x sub I. And if we have a 1 there, we're going to get x sub I xored with 1. In other words, we're going to get the negation of that bit. Right. So this is what I see. And now what you can see is that, well, you know, regardless of whether xi is equal to 0 or xi is equal to 1, the thing that you have here is, you know, basically the same state, right? There's two possibilities. I mean, I guess I could just write it down explicitly because there's only two cases, right? So this is I times you know, 0 minus 1 over root 2 if xi is equal to 0. And it's, well, you know, if xi is equal to 1, then what we have here is just 1 minus 0 over root 2. Right, so that's what we have. And, you know, this is just the same state, except that there's a global minus sign, right? So in other words, we can write this state as minus 1 to the x sub I, and then the minus state. So the effect of putting this particular state in the second register, of putting a minus state in the second register, is that instead of computing the value x sub I in the register, so instead of computing it, you know, over here, we compute it in the phase, right? So now we have a quantum state where the phase of the state encodes the bit that we wanted to query. So, you know, of course, if we only query on one index I, this is a pretty stupid thing to do because the information has gone into a global phase, and a global phase is not, you know, there's no information we can get out about the global phase. But now if we would instead query on a superposition of different indices I, then, you know, this could become a relative phase between different terms of the superposition, and that could potentially do useful things. So that's what we're going to do, is we're going to think about computing the information into the phase of the state, and somehow this will allow us to get some interference going that's going to be helpful. That's going to help us to get the answer out faster. Okay, questions about this? Okay, good. All right, so now I'm going to just tell you what the algorithm is, and then we're going to analyze it. And I'm just going to draw a quantum circuit. And it's going to be a pretty simple quantum circuit. You know, it's going to only involve one query, because I said there should be a one query algorithm. And we'll just kind of see what it does. Okay, so remember that this index I, you know, this specifies some bit of the string x, and so we could imagine writing that down as a number in binary. So let's say we just use, you know, n qubits to represent the n possible things that we might want to query. And so something that might make sense would be to try to query on a uniform superposition of inputs, right? I mean, you know, the information about whether the function is constant or balanced is not in any one particular bit of the string. It's somehow in all of them. So somehow we have to get information out about all of the all of the bits of x in order to figure out whether the function is constant or balanced. So maybe a reasonable thing to do is to try to query on a uniform superposition of all of the possible inputs. So let's do that. We're going to start with n qubits in the state 0. So here we have n qubits. And we're going to apply Hadamard gates to all of them. And what that's going to do is it's going to make a uniform superposition over all of the possible places that we might query. Okay? And then we're going to have another register that's going to be the place where we compute the function value. And we're going to use this trick. So we're going to put that thing in a minus state. All right, so this is our kind of initial state. And then we're going to perform a query. So this is, I guess I didn't name the query anything, so I'll just write query. And now, if we were to say just measure in the computational basis at this point, you know, what you would see is that you don't learn anything, because although in some sense when you've made this query, you've created a quantum state that has information in it about all of the possible bits of x. You know, you haven't made them interfere in any useful way. So, you know, when we analyze this, we'll see what the quantum state is here, and you'll see that if we were to measure at that point, we wouldn't learn anything. But what we can do instead is, you know, somehow create some interference between all of the different branches of the computation. And a way of doing that is, again, to just apply Hadamard gates on all of the qubits. Well, all of these qubits. This thing is just going to come out in a minus state. We know that because, you know, we know that we got a minus state here regardless of what input we had here. So, you know, this is just going to be a minus state, and we're just not going to worry about it. We're not going to do anything with it. But here we're going to apply Hadamard gates on everything. Okay. And then we're just going to measure all of these output qubits. And somehow by looking at the measurement results over here, we're going to figure out whether the function is constant or balanced. So I claim that by looking at what comes out over here, there's some way of interpreting this n-bit outcome that lets you determine this one bit of information you want to know, which is whether the function is constant or balanced. Okay. Is that all right? Good. All right, so now what we should do is we should analyze how this algorithm behaves. So what happens, first of all, when we apply these Hadamard gates? Well, so remember, this Hadamard gate is just described by this matrix. So if I, if I start with a qubit in the zero state and apply the Hadamard gate, then the output is just the plus state, which is 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1. Right? So if I do this n times, on all of these n qubits, so you might write that like this. So, this is like the n-fold tensor product of the Hadamard gate with itself. If I act with this on the input, which is, the all zero string, so, here I mean maybe I shouldn't write exactly the same thing. I guess I could write this to mean the n-fold tensor product of, qubits in the state zero. Well, this is just, of course, n copies of the plus state. Okay. But if I think about taking this thing and expanding it out, when I take the tensor product of this with itself n times, I just get, I can just distribute things over the tensor product, and I have all of the possible ways of taking either a 0 or a 1 from every factor in the tensor product. Right? So in other words, what I'm going to get is there's going to be a normalizing factor here of 1 over root 2 to the n, and then I have a sum over all, I think I'm going to write x. I hope this isn't confusing. So this x is not the input string, but this is now something that you should think of as an index into a position of the input string. So this is going to be this is going to be an n-bit string, whereas that x is a 2 to the n-bit string. So in other words, this is the state that I get when I perform all of these Hadamard gates. So it's a uniform superposition over all the possible n-bit strings, each with the same phase, and then there's just this normalizing factor. Is this okay? All right, good. So what I've just described so far is the state here, except that I haven't written down the qubit and the minus state, but I'm not going to write that down at all. I'm just going to kind of forget about this thing is there. It's implicitly there all the way along, but all it's going to do is allow me to perform a query that is going to put this phase of minus 1 to the x sub I in front of the term of the state where I have, I'm querying the ith bit. Okay. So now what should I do? So I should try to figure out what the state is here, right? So so now I have 1 over root 2 to the n sum x in 0, 1 to the n. So now what I'm going to get here is a phase of minus 1 to the value of the string. So I guess, yeah, this is going to get really confusing, actually, if I use, I shouldn't do this. I mean, I shouldn't use x for both things. So I'm sorry, I'm going to change this. I'm going to call this I. Because I guess I really, I really should, so that I is really the same as this I. So, I'm thinking of the index into this string x as a, so this is an n-bit string that indexes one of the 2 to the n positions of x. Okay? So let me just do that so that I don't get confused. And then, what I have here is, I'm going to get a phase of minus 1 to the x sub I associated with querying the position I. Right? So this is the state that I get after I apply this query. Right? So this state is the state for these n qubits. And I also have this qubit in a minus state, but I'm just not writing it. Is that okay? All right. So this is the state that I have so far. And now you can see what I was saying before, that if we were to measure at this point, there's really not any useful information, right? If I were to measure, the information is all in the phases. So if I were to measure, I would just get some uniformly random index, and that would just tell me nothing about whether the string x is constant or balanced. So somehow I have to make the different, you know, amplitudes in this state interfere in order to have something useful. All right. So now what I want to do is I want to understand what happens when I apply a Hadamard transform to this state. So I'm applying Hadamard gates on all the n qubits, and I want to know what that does. And so let's just make a quick aside and try to understand in general what this Hadamard transform does, right? So suppose, first of all, just that I have a single Hadamard gate, right? And suppose I have a qubit, which is in the state, which is in a computational basis state A. So A is either 0 or 1. So if I apply a Hadamard gate to that, what do I get? Well, I either get the plus state or the minus state, depending on whether A equals 0 or 1. But one way of writing that is the following. So this is like, 1 over root 2, the sum B equals 0 to 1 minus 1 to the A times B, B. Right? I mean, this may seem like a very convoluted way to write a sum with two terms in it. But it's correct, right? So the term where b is equal to 0 always has a phase of plus 1. So that's, because I always just want to have the state ket 0 in there. But then the state ket 1 will either have a plus sign or a minus sign in front of it, depending upon whether a is 0 or 1. Right? OK, so that's, that's kind of a way of writing what the Hadamard gate does. But now suppose that I want to do this Hadamard transform acting on all n qubits on some n-bit string I, right? So I is this thing that I'm thinking of as an index into X. Okay. What's that going to be? Well, now I just have, this thing acting independently on every one of the qubits. And so this is just, there's going to be a factor of 1 over root 2 to the n. And then there's going to be, a sum. What's a good variable? I guess I'll call it J. So J in 0, 1 to the n. And I'm just going to have here minus 1 to the I dot j, j, right? Because I just have a bunch of phases. I just have a minus 1 every time one of the bits of j and the corresponding bit of I are both 1, right? And otherwise I have no contribution here, right? So I just took this thing. I just took, the tensor product of n copies of something like this, where I have a bunch of different bits A and a bunch of different bits B that would appear in the sum, and the corresponding thing is this. Is this all right? Okay. So you can view this, if you like, as this Hadamard transform. Actually, you can think of as the Fourier transform over a group. This is the Fourier transform over the group Z2 to the n. And so what we'll do when we talk about Shor's algorithm, we'll talk about order finding and phase estimation and Shor's algorithm. And those things will all be using a different Fourier transform, a Fourier transform over a cyclic group. And actually, more generally, there are interesting things you could do with quantum algorithms that involve Fourier transforms, even over non-abelian groups. There's a really interesting theory of the Fourier analysis on those groups that comes into play in some quantum algorithms. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to get to any of that stuff in this course, but there's some neat stuff out there. OK, so this is how the Hadamard transform behaves. So now we're all set up to do a little calculation where we work out what happens when we apply the Hadamard transform to that state, right? So so what we can say is that the final state before the measurement is the following. So let's see. So we have one factor of 1 over root 2 to the n over there. And here we have another factor of 1 over root 2 to the n. So we're going to have a factor of 1 over 2 to the n out front. And now in that thing, we have a sum over I. So we have sum over I. But then we're also going to have a sum over j, because every term ket I in that sum is going to have associated with it a sum over j. So this is sum over I and j in 0, 1 to the n. And then there's a phase of minus 1 to the xi from that state. And then there's this phase of I dot j here, j. I mean, incidentally, when I write I dot j, what I mean is really just the scalar product between these two vectors of bits. And you can think about that either, you know, if you like, you can think about that as an integer, or you can think about doing the arithmetic over the field with two elements. It's really the same thing, because we're going to take minus 1 to the power of that thing. So all that really matters is whether I dot j is even or odd. Right? So this is just the inner product between those vectors of bits. And, you know, it probably makes sense to think about it over F2, but you can think about it as an integer if you prefer. Okay. So this thing is, you know, this is the final quantum state. And from this, we can work out what is the probability that we see any particular outcome j. Right? The probability that we see some particular outcome j is just the squared amplitude of the corresponding coefficient. So it's just the following. So 1 over 2 to the 2n, you know, the sum over I in 0, 1 to the n minus 1 to the xi plus I dot j. Right. So that's the distribution that I see when I make the final measurement in this quantum circuit. And this thing, you know, this sum over I minus 1 to the xi plus I dot j, I mean, there's a way of interpreting this. It's the Fourier transform of a certain function on the Boolean cube, right? So this x, you can think of it as defining some function over the Boolean hypercube. And if you take this Fourier transform over Z2, I mean, that's exactly what this is. So somehow the quantum algorithm is allowing us to sample from the Fourier transform of the input. It's sort of the interpretation of what's going on. Okay, but now what we should do is we should try to understand something about the distribution and how it relates to whether the function is, to whether the string X is constant or balanced. Okay? So, something that would be maybe useful to look at would be the probability that we see the all zero string, right? So here J is a string. It's the string of bits that we see, string of n bits that we see when we make that measurement over there. So, you know, something that would be easy to calculate, I mean, it turns out to also be useful, but something that's easy to calculate is the probability that we see the all zero string, right? Because if J is the all zero string, then this term just isn't there, right? Because if you take the inner product of anything with the all zero string, you're just going to get zero. So in particular, the probability that we see the all zero string when we measure, so this zero is the, you know, it's the n-bit string of zeros. This is 1 over 2 to the 2n sum over I in 0, 1 to the n minus 1 to the x of I squared, just that. Okay, so now maybe you can already see how it is that we can distinguish constant, you know, the case where x is constant from the case where x is balanced, right? So if x is constant, then what's the probability that we see the all zero string? Pardon? One. Yes, it's one. All right, so this is one because I have 2 to the n terms in the sum. I square that. I get 2 to the 2n, so I just get 1. Right, so it's just 1. I mean, of course, it could be that this thing, you know, inside the absolute value is minus 1 if it was the constant 1 string. So, you know, but all that we really care about for taking the probability is, you know, the absolute value, so that's fine. There's some information in the phase about whether it's the all zero string or the all one string, but that's information that's not accessible to us anyway. So, you know, this is the probability that we see the all zero string if the string x is constant. Okay, but now, so that's good. So that sort of tells us, you know, one thing about maybe how we should interpret the measurement results, right? If we want to have a deterministic algorithm, it had better be that when we have a non-constant x, which because of this promise means we have a balanced x, it had better be that we never get the all zero string, right? And then something that we can do is that when we perform the circuit and we make the measurement, if we see the all zero string, then we say, okay, the string x is constant. And if we see you know, any other string, then we say, okay, the string x is balanced. Right? So that turns out to be the case, and that's also pretty easy to see. Because, you know, if x is balanced, okay, that's why we had this promise that if it wasn't constant, it was balanced. If x is balanced, then there's an equal number of terms in this sum that are plus 1 as there are that are minus 1, right? So then the probability that we see the L0 string is 0. So that's what you do. You apply the circuit, and you look to see whether you get the L0 string or not. And if you don't get the L0 string, you get any other string at all, then you can say that you know that X is balanced, and otherwise you can say that it's constant. So, and you know, this circuit only used one query. So what this shows is that the quantum query complexity, and in fact, even the deterministic quantum query complexity, where we demand that we're always correct, so even deterministic, is 1. So that's a big separation between classical and quantum computation. The best classical deterministic strategy needed an exponential number of queries. Okay. So that's nice. But if you think about it for maybe another minute, it maybe seems not so nice, because what we would really like to do, you know, is, well, okay, so first of all, we don't want to think about black boxes. We want to think about explicit problems, but we're not going to get away from that. But what we would really like, you know, at least even in the context of black boxes, is to think about separations between quantum and randomized computation. You know, in general, we won't necessarily be able to ensure that even our quantum computations succeed with certainty. It does here, but in general, they won't. And you know, if we believe that it's feasible to run randomized computations in practice, then we would like to really have separations against that model. So what can we say about the randomized classical query complexity of this problem now? Suppose we can make some random choices when we decide how to query x. You know, what can you say about how many queries we need to make before we can figure out what the answer is? What do you think? So, you know, I have a string which consists of either all zeros or all ones, or else it's half zeros and half ones, and I want to figure out which is the case, right? So what's a good randomized strategy? Right. Well, right. So if you pick at random which positions to look at, you know, certainly if you ever see two different function values, then you know the function has to be balanced. Like, you don't have to see half the values to tell that it's balanced. You just have to see two different values because you have this promise. So once you see two different values, you're good. So let's say we use the strategy that you're suggesting. You know, if we're just querying in random places, I mean, let's even do it, you know, with replacement. So we just, like, each time we independently choose one of the bits and then we query it, right? So this is kind of like the problem that, you know, somebody gives you a coin and it either has two heads on it or it's a fair coin and it has a head and a tail, right? And you just flip the coin and you can tell which it is. Well, you can be sure that you're right if you ever see both a head and a tail, right? And you know, of course, if it's a coin with two heads, then no surprise that every time you flip it, you see a head, right? And the question is, how many times do you have to flip that coin before you can tell if it's the two-headed coin or the heads and tails coin? Well, you wouldn't expect to have to flip it very many times, right? Like, you would expect to have to flip it something like a constant number of times before you would see both a head and a tail if it's a fair coin, right? So you know, what this says is that the randomized query complexity of this problem is actually constant. Right, so if I'm just picking random positions, then I would only expect to see a constant number of, you know, to do this a constant number of times before I could tell that I was in the balanced case. Right? So, you know, if I do something like I just query in 100 randomly chosen positions, you know, if I see that every one of them is a zero, I can be pretty sure it's the constant zero function. And you know, if I ever see both a zero and a one, then I know that it's balanced. Yes. Yes, but it won't work. No, you can't use the algorithm. Right. So it depends what the nature of the promise is, right? So like so something you could be asking would be like, is it constant, balanced, or a third option, neither constant nor balanced, right? Right. So that's sort of like saying there are three possibilities, right? Constant, balanced, or something that you want to reject. So that's actually a much harder problem, right? So that's not something you can solve with one quantum query. you know, because, for example, it could be that it's close to constant, but it differs in just one position. Or it's close to balance, but it differs in just one position. And those are very, you know, certainly this strategy is not going to give very different probabilities for the outcomes under those two distributions, you know, for those two possibilities. So this algorithm definitely is not going to work. But more than that, you can actually prove that you would need a large number of queries to distinguish those possibilities,
so
even with a quantum computer.
The quantum algorithm does not do much better than the possible one.
That's right. And in fact, not only this algorithm, but no quantum algorithm. I mean, for certain problems, you could show that no quantum algorithm would do much better. Yeah. I mean, I think for this very problem, so certainly you can show that you would need at least the square root of 2 to the n quantum queries for that problem, because just even distinguishing the constant functions from non-constant functions takes that many queries. I think you could actually show that you need like a constant times 2 to the n queries. I would have to think about that a little bit. Okay, so yeah, I mean, definitely the structure of the problem is really important here. I mean, the fact that we have this promise is absolutely essential to the fact that the quantum algorithm can work. And there's actually a pretty general result that says that if you don't, I mean, let me not describe it formally, but just say if you don't have a promise of this kind, then actually you can't have an exponential quantum speedup. The best you can have is a polynomial quantum speedup. Okay, so so this is, you know, something which is kind of disappointing. So the randomized query complexity is constant. And, you know, what constant it is depends on what success probability you demand. But if we just talk about, you know, bounded error, and we just talk about what's the, you know, we just want to give some kind of big O expression, we can say certainly that just you would need a constant number of queries. Okay? All right, so so that's the Deutsch-Joseph problem. So actually, maybe we have more time than I expected to talk about Simon's problem, which is an example that actually gives you a bigger separation. So. So it's possible to get better separations, and so Simon's problem is an example of something like that. So Simon's problem is, so I think I'm going to have to change the notation a little bit. I'm really going to have to do this in the other notation to be able to get things straight. So I'm going to think about this in a different way, that we're really given a black box function f that's going to take some input x, which is the thing that I called I here, and then the values that are inside the black box are really going to be given by some function applied to that. So the problem is the following. We're going to be given a black box function f, which is going to map. And so now the output is actually not going to be binary. So every time we query the black box, it's not just going to tell us a bit, but it's actually going to tell us a value from some larger set. So the thing that we give as input to the black box will again be an input string, just as it was over there, although I'm writing it in a somewhat different notation. But then the output will be a value from some finite set. It doesn't really matter, actually, what the values in this finite set are. It just has to be a set that's big enough in order for a promise that I'm going to tell you about in a moment to be true. Okay, so this is some finite set. Okay, and there's going to be a promise again, which is the following, that f of x is going to be, well, it's going to be a 2-to-1 function. But it's going to be a particular kind of 2-to-1 function. So f of x is going to be equal to f of x prime if and only if. Okay, well, one way that could be true is, of course, if x is equal to x prime. No way of getting around that. But the other way that it could be the case is that if the way you get from x to x prime is that you XOR with some fixed string. So x prime is equal to x, So this is going to mean bitwise XOR, because these things X are n-bit strings, bitwise XORed with some string S. This S has nothing to do with this S. Maybe this one we're not going to use very much. So let me just change this to, I don't know, sigma. OK, so this is some hidden n-bit string. But now I'm only telling you something about like the level sets of the function, the places where the function takes some particular value. I'm not telling you what the values are or any relationship between the values. I mean, I haven't even told you what the set is that the values come from. So all that really matters about this function, and the only information that we'll use in the algorithm, will be, you know, whether the function is the same on two particular inputs or whether it's different. Okay, so you know, there's a way of kind of thinking about this that you can pair up all of the n-bit strings in some way to give you some values, some places where the function takes the same value. So for example, there's the 0 string, and that one is paired with S, right? Because the way you get from 0, you know, if you XOR the all 0 string with S, of course you get S, and if you XOR S with itself, of course you get back to 0, right? And then I could take some other string, you know, X, and that's going to be paired with X XORed with S. And there's some way of, you know, dividing up the whole space into pairs so that, you know, these pairs are the things where the function takes a particular value. So the function takes some value on this pair, and it doesn't take that value anywhere else. And then it takes some different value on these two inputs, and it doesn't take the same value anywhere else. Is it clear what the promise is? Okay. And now the problem is going to be to find S. Right. Okay. So now there are again, you know, maybe two things that we need to think about. So one is, you know, we need to find a quantum algorithm that's going to find S using not too many queries to the black box. But the other thing is to think about the classical query complexity. So let's think about that first, because it's maybe easier to think about classical algorithms. So how would you know, what's a strategy for finding S, right? How many queries can you get by with? Right? So, you know, clearly one strategy is take all of the possible n-bit strings, query F on them, you know, and then that determines what S is, and you know, we don't even worry about how much computation it takes to find it out. It's at that point it would be determined, right? So 2 to the n queries would certainly suffice, because that's the maximum number of queries. But can you do better than that? You think of a strategy? Yeah, so you could try querying in random positions. You know, that's sort of like the strategy that we used for the last problem. So why not try it again? So how would you know that you've let's suppose you take this strategy that you just query in randomly chosen positions. How would you learn what S is from the results of those queries? That's right. You need to find two that match. You need to find a collision, right? So if you find two inputs where the function value is the same, then you can just XOR those two inputs together, and that value gives you the hidden string S, right? So that's what you would be looking for, is a collision. And you would be able to tell that just by testing equality of the function values. And you know, because this set is completely unstructured, it sort of seems like there's not really much else you could do than that, right? Because you can't really make much use of the function values. There's not really much you can do other than just test equality. And when you start out querying, you know, you have no function values available, so it doesn't really seem like there should be much more you could do than just to pursue this strategy that you're suggesting of querying at random, right? Okay, but so now there's a question, right? This is now just a question in probability, right? Suppose we have a 2-to-1 function, and we query it on random inputs. How many times do we expect to have to query before we see a collision? So it's a lot less than that. So that you know, if you queried without replacement, then after that number of queries, you could be sure that you would see a collision. But yeah, I mean, sort of like, yeah, how many queries would you expect to have to make? Like, if you do it without replacement, then then I agree that you can be guaranteed that after that many, you'll succeed. But maybe you would be, you know, maybe you could find something sooner. It's easier to do the analysis again if you think about querying, you know, like maybe without replacement. Well, I mean, it maybe doesn't matter so much. But there's a problem that you often study in a course on probability theory. It's exactly this. I don't know if you've seen this before. There's something called the birthday problem. You heard of this? Yeah, so maybe some of you have. Right, so this is like, you know, this is the question. Suppose you have a room full of people and you want to find two people that have the same birthday. And let's assume that, you know, birthdays are uniformly distributed throughout the year. I think that's not actually true, but, you know, suppose they are roughly. You know, how many people would you expect to have to go through before you would find two with the same birthday? If, you know, everybody gets up one at a time and says what their birthday is, and you stop when you find two people that have the same birthday. And the answer is about the square root of the number of days in the year. Right? So you do some analysis, and that's what you get. And so that's what you would have here, that like the number of queries that you would have to make before you would find a collision would go like the square root of the number of inputs. Right? So there's a classical strategy that you query at random. And that strategy uses about the square root of 2 to the n queries. So, you know, that's an upper bound. But could you do better? So it turns out that you can't do dramatically better. So you can prove that. And, you know, to prove that, you have to sort of like formalize, you know, how you would prove query lower bounds and, you know, how would you actually understand that that really is the best strategy. But there is some way of showing that. I mean, we're not going to do it here. But in fact, this is a lower bound. OK, so that's kind of good, because that says that you really need to make exponentially many queries with a classical randomized algorithm. So what can you do with a quantum computer? So it turns out that you can get by with many fewer queries. Actually, a linear number of queries suffices. So now not a constant number of queries, but a linear number of queries. And you can see this actually by analyzing a one query subroutine. So there's a simple thing you can do that just takes one query. And what you can see is that you have to put together the results of many such units in order to figure out what S is. I mean, after all, well, I don't know, you have to get n bits of information in order to figure out what S is. So maybe it's not surprising that you need to have many of these subroutines. But the sort of simple thing that you have to analyze to figure out what's going on is, again, just a one query algorithm that has a very similar structure to that. So let's maybe do, I guess, as much of that analysis as we can in the time that we have. OK, so the algorithm is going to be as follows. So again, we're going to have n bits that are that are going to specify some bit x that we want to query. And we're going to put them in a uniform superposition. But actually, for this algorithm, we won't use phase kickback. We'll just put this thing in a zero state and query in superposition. So this is going to be our query. And what that query means is going to be, you know, we've got here x, and then some register, you know, z, which is now some bit string that represents elements from that set sigma. And this is going to get mapped to x, z xored with f of x. Right? This is the kind of analog of the standard reversible computation of some black box function. And then we're again just going to do Hadamard gates on everything in measure. So I mean, it looks like it's almost the same algorithm. I mean, it really is, except that we're not using phase kickback. Okay. So let's figure out what the algorithm does, right? So after the first set of Hadamard gates, what do we have? So then we'll have. We'll have this, and then we'll have a zero in the second register. And you know, I normally try not to do these things by erasing, but maybe here I will, because in the next step we're just going to query, and we're going to get the value f of x in this register. I mean, we XOR that thing onto this register, but it started out as a zero, so we're just going to get f of x there. Okay. And so now there's sort of a way of rewriting this that's maybe useful, which is to think about you know, some way of pairing these up. And let's imagine that we just choose one representative from each of these pairs, right? So let's take the, you know, we just draw them like this. And we take the ones on the bottom. We just draw them in some arbitrary way. And we'll call this set R. So this is a set of representatives of the pairs. I mean, you can think about them as coset representatives of some set of cosets. And so you can write this thing as like 1 over root 2 to the n minus 1, the sum over all of these representatives, x plus s over root 2 f of x, right? Because you know, here we have some string x, and here we have some other string where we have the same function value, right? F of x plus s is the same thing as f of x. So these two terms go together. So let's just collect them together. And now what we're going to do is we're actually just going to look at this state, and we're going to see what happens if we Hadamard transform it and measure. And you know, we're not actually going to even look at this value, right? This value f of x, we're not even measuring it up there. So you know, if things work for any one term in this superposition corresponding to a particular f of x, then things will work in general. Right? So we're just going to look term by term. But because we're just measuring, we're just going to, you know, perform some Hadamard transform here and measure without doing anything to this register. If it works just on one term in the superposition, it'll actually just work in general. And you'll see that actually what happens will not really depend on which term in the superposition we have anyway. Okay. All right. So now we're going to perform the Hadamard transform. All right. So so how do we do that? So we can again just use this this identity that we have here, except you know, I use this slightly different notation here. So you know, I and j are going to become x and y. So now what I have is like so 1 over root 2 to the n plus 1. So I mean, this is a normalized state. So I'm just imagining that I have this normalized state. One way of getting this, you know, one of these normalized states, by the way, would be just to measure this register. And then the state would collapse onto, you know, one of the particular function values here. And this would be exactly the state that would be associated with that outcome. So I mean, we don't actually have to perform that measurement, but that's another way of thinking about it, if it's helpful conceptually. OK, so I'm going to take that state. I'm going to Fourier transform it. I have the 1 over root 2 from this, and I have the 1 over root 2 to the n from that. And then I'm going to have a sum, y in 0, 1 to the n of, so now I have, well, minus 1 to the x dot y. Associated with this term, and then for this term I have minus 1 to the x plus s dot y. Right? So that's the state that I get when I Hadamard transform. Right? And now you see that there's some global phase of minus 1 to the x dot y that I can just pull out, because you know, here x was some information about which representative I was looking at. And I don't actually, you know, there's no useful information in that anyway. And fortunately, that information just goes into a global phase. So this is 1 over root 2 to the n plus 1 minus 1 to the x dot y. Sorry. I mean, it's inside the sum, but it's not truly a global phase, but it's not going to affect the outcomes of measurements, because I'm just going to measure this thing in the computational basis. So sorry, this is the sum y from 0, 1 to the n. Here's my minus 1 to the x dot y. And then what I have here is 1 plus minus 1 to the s dot y, y. Right. OK, so what I can see from this is that the probability that I see any particular string y when I make that final measurement is just given by the absolute square of the amplitude associated with y. So that's 1 over 2 to the n plus 1 times 1 plus minus 1 to the s dot y squared. Right? So now what can I say about this thing? Well, this really just takes one of two values, right? Because this is just minus 1 to the power of, you know, again, we might as well think about this inner product as being done over F2. So you can just think about this as being 0 or 1. All that really matters is whether it's even or odd. And so this is either going to be 1 plus 1 or it's going to be 1 minus 1, right? So this is equal to 2 if s dot y is equal to 0. And it's going to be equal to 0 otherwise. So, and you know, there's no other dependence on what particular y that you have. So there's a nice way of interpreting this, which is that what you see is a uniformly random y that's orthogonal to S, where it's orthogonality in the sense of like linear algebra over GF2, over the field with two elements, right? So we see a uniformly random y that is orthogonal to S. Right. Okay. So now what we would like to do is we would like to, we would like to recover S by sampling from this kind of distribution, right? I mean, clearly, if you just do this once, you don't have much information about what S is. You've just determined, you know, you've just specified one linear equation, but there are lots of possible choices of S that could satisfy the condition that you might see. But now suppose that you do this, you know, t times, right? So let's say we do this t times, and then what you would get is a bunch of linear equations. You would get a bunch of randomly chosen y's, y1 dot s is equal to 0, y2 dot s is equal to 0, et cetera, where all the y's are being chosen uniformly at random, subject to the fact that this condition has to hold, right? So you know what these y's are, and you want to figure out what the s is that satisfies these linear equations. OK, so now the question is, how many of these equations do you need to have before they uniquely determine s? So what do you think? So how big does t have to be? Log 2 to the n, right? Because you know we have n bits that we want to determine. There are n variables that we're solving for, the bits of s, and so you know we need to have we basically just need to have n equations before it's uniquely determined, right? So this now of course you know we're not promised that every time we see one of these things we get a linearly independent equation from what we've seen before. So there's some, you know, analysis maybe to do to see exactly how many equations will be good enough in expectation. But it shouldn't be surprising to you that, you know, if you would take a constant times n, I mean, in fact, if you would take n, you would with constant probability already determine s. So, but you know, if you took 100 times n, then it shouldn't be surprising at all that would determine s. So, so this will determine s with constant probability if t is big enough. So if t is, let's say if t is bigger than or equal to n. So now, you know, if you have these equations, then these are just linear equations, so you can use Gaussian elimination to figure out what s is. And so this is a quantum query algorithm that uses only a linear number of queries for a problem that, you know, classically would need exponentially many queries. Questions? I see some yawns. It's kind of late in the day. So I guess we should stop there. So on Monday, we'll pick back up, and then we'll start to see some of the elements that we need for the factoring algorithm, where, you know, the main thing we'll do is we'll take this Hadamard transform, we'll generalize it to another kind of Fourier transform, and that'll turn out to be useful for something that will let us solve factors.